she thinks she's in love with him, and he is a friend of her mother's. Okay, chapter 5, Dead Body. Easter is spent in the glare of Eddie and Cynthia's whitewashed villa. People come and go incessantly. When the sun shines, oiled women in bright bikinis toast themselves by the pool, which is shaped like a guitar. The house once belonged to a singer, very famous, but only in France, who was said to have swum out to sea and never returned. "Isn't the weather good for Easter?" they say, as they surreptitiously eye each other's bodies for signs of cellulite and surgery. Men hover in loud shirts, with louder laughs, smoking thin cigarettes and talking about money, while thinking dirty thoughts about each other's wives, who lie on display like meat, they think. Lavish meals appear and disappear on the terrace, fat white asparagus lying on the plate like a row of corpses under a thick cloak of hollandaise, complicated terrines with striated layers like ill-painted landscapes, unrecognisable innards trapped in glossy aspic. Amy slips her food to the dog that sits at her feet under the table. Cynthia is hardly seen, except for at lunch and dinner, where she barely says a word, but sits with a beatific half-smile and empty eyes, her skin so translucently pale that the veins show in her forehead. Her presence is like a barely audible whisper. Frosted bottles of rosé drip coolly onto the white tablecloth. Simply Red is on repeat, the soundtrack of Easter. And Amy smells the familiar acrid smoke of the joints that are passed round when the small cups of coffee, dark like oil, appear. After dinner, when the sun has gone and the night chill has set in, someone usually says, "On va en boîte, non?" This is their cue to rise. The women squeeze their swollen feet into espadrilles bought on shopping trips to town, which tie round their brown calves like ballet shoes, while the men tut impatiently. Then they totter drunkenly, giggling like children, to their waiting cars and drive off down the hill. Amy never goes to the nightclubs with them and is always glad of this oasis of peace with only the maid shuffling and clanking as she clears the aftermath of dinner. She sits in the dark on the terrace, wrapped in a shawl, listening to the thrum of the crickets, with thoughts of Fausto crisscrossing her mind, forming into ever more complex episodes. Cynthia often stays behind too, wafting round like a spectre. Amy only knows she's there from the occasional quiet closing of a door or the whisper of her feet on the tiles. Sometimes she stands on the terrace, oblivious to Amy, looking out towards the dark sea far below, wringing her hands like Lady Macbeth. "She's so thin," Amy thinks. "She might snap in the breeze." A boy arrives with his father and stays for a few days. He wears white trousers and has white blonde hair. His eyes are shards of ice and his hands are long and thin like a pianist's. His name is Xavier, and he chats politely to everyone, but avoids Amy. He's found the best way to attract a girl's attention is to ignore her, so he does this, indiscriminately, to any girl he comes across of more or less his age, whether he likes them or not. Xavier joins the adults on visits to town and to the beach, and plays tennis aggressively on the dusty court that sits above the house, with his father standing on the side, shouting out a running critique. Xavier's presence doesn't have an impact on Amy, who reads in the shade and occasionally takes long solitary walks amongst the wild flowers that proliferate in the hills. She's reading Tender is the Night because it's a Côte d'Azur story. People with money, she thinks, are all the same. Her head continues to swim with scenarios starring Fausto, but time has distorted and partly erased her image of him, and his face has become muddled with other faces, both seen and imagined. Her fantasies have become long and complex, like the plots of old black and white films, always ending with a passionate reunion. She falls into his arms. They all come to abrupt end in the same way. She can't see into the dark unknown beyond the embrace. Sometimes she plots her escape, finding out the times of the buses into town and the location of the train station. She could leave late when everyone's out, take the night train to Paris, and from there a flight to London. Then what? She can never find a satisfactory ending for her story. And besides, she only has £22 in her bank account and a few francs in her purse. She feels Xavier's cold eyes on her occasionally, unaware he's disarticulating her, thinking, if she had a different face, if she had bigger tits, but those legs. She's unaware, too, that he's aroused by her lack of interest. He's not used to girls who don't notice him, particularly plain, nothing special girls like Amy. He thinks about his first time with the large-breasted woman who looks after his little sister in Paris, how she whispered filthy things in his ear with her hot breath, and his furtive fumblings the previous week with the beautiful but uptight Adeline, the daughter of family friends, who he knows will eventually give it up for him, and the girl at the party after Christmas, whose name he's forgotten, who took him in her mouth. He hides in a damp leafy corner outside Amy's bedroom window, watching through a chink in the curtains as she undresses, and strokes his cock with his pianist fingers, snarling, "Salop," as he climaxes. The weather closes in, bringing grey, fat-bellied clouds from the sea, and the guests drift back to their lives. Cynthia leaves too, but her absence, like her presence, is barely felt. Lillian takes her place in the bed with Eddie. Amy hears their loud panting sex at night. She presses a pillow over her ears and counts the hours until she can go back to school. "It's about time you went on the pill," says Lillian one morning. "Shh," hisses Amy from between clenched teeth, throwing a look towards the hunched figure of Eddie, who sits on the terrace with his back to them, reading the newspaper. "Oh, don't be silly. He can't hear. Wouldn't be interested anyway." Amy's face is pink and hot. "I've made an appointment with a local doctor. The French are so much more open-minded about these things." "But, Mummy, I don't need..." Amy is still hissing. "For goodness sake, darling, I do know about these things." She pauses. "And I'd rather you called me Lillian. You're too old for Mummy. It sounds ridiculous." The doctor's office is above a boulangerie, and the scent of baking bread mingles awkwardly with the sharp smell of disinfectant. They sit in silence, Lillian flicking through a copy of Parry Match until the brusque receptionist sends them through. The doctor has brown, deeply lined skin, like a walnut, and a velvet voice. Lillian answers all his questions, and he writes notes in a folder. "Now, mademoiselle," he says to Amy, getting up and crossing the room to a couch. "I must examine you. Take off your clothes and lie down." He taps the couch. She sits on the edge with her back to them and undresses while the doctor chats with Lillian. "Very sensible," he says, "to be cautious. So many girls get caught out. Now lie down, dear," he says to Amy, "and bend your knees, that's right." He squeezes her breasts and stomach, then rubber-gloved spreads cold gel between her legs and pushes his fingers inside, exploring her. "Mmm," he says occasionally. Amy lies still as a doll, staring at the ceiling. It is made of white square tiles, and there is a bright strip light running down the middle, with a dead fly trapped inside. Lillian flicks through her magazine. The doctor's fingers prod interminably. His other hand rests on the couch near her head. She imagines biting it hard, so hard she can taste the blood. "Everything seems as it should be," he pronounces, pulling off the glove with a twang and washing his hands at a sink in the corner. "You can get dressed now," and he sits to write the prescription. "Oh, for goodness sake, stop sulking," says Lillian in the car. "You should count yourself lucky to have an open-minded mother like me." Amy shrinks wordlessly into the seat, and they drive on in silence, winding up the coast road with the scent of lavender filling the air. "What on earth?" gasps Lillian all of a sudden, slowing the car. In the middle of the road in front is a large dark shape like a fallen rock. "What is it?" asks Amy. Lillian pulls the car onto the verge and they get out cautiously, approaching the dark object. "Oh my God, it's a man." Lillian's voice is full of shock and Amy sees him now, his frayed black coat and face scrumpled like an old paper bag. His eyes are closed as if he's sleeping. The two women stand rooted to the spot for what seems like an age, staring at his motionless body. "Get my handbag," barks Lillian suddenly, breaking the silence. Amy runs back to the car, bringing the bag back to her mother, who rummages in it, producing a small gold compact. Amy wonders what her mother wants with makeup now, and watches in confusion, wondering what she should do to help, as Lillian opens the compact and holds it close to the man's deflated face. "He's breathing," she announces, clicking the mirror shut. come on, don't just stand there like a bloody lemon. We need to get him out of the road. You take his legs. They half lift, half drag him to the verge. He's too heavy to move further. They can barely lift him as it is. Amy pretends he's not real, a giant puppet or something, and tries not to look at the paper-thin skin of his ankles or the coarse hand that drags in the dust, and tries not to hear the long animal moan that escapes from his mouth. You stay here with him and I'll go for help, says her mother. Amy hears the slam of the door and watches the car disappear in the direction of the town. She stands for some time, unsure what to do, remembering her father, who was old too, like this. She squats beside him and takes his hand. It's rough and dry like sandpaper, with thick yellow nails and bulging veins. She wills the blood to keep pumping through them and begins to talk. She speaks in English and is sure he can't understand, but wants him to know he's not alone. She tells him all about her father, the bluebell woods, the blue angels, the dancer on the desk, the books. Lines of a poem long forgotten slip into her head and she begins to recite. Here I am, an old man in a dry month, being read to by a boy, waiting for rain. Something changes, nothing visible, but a subtle shift in the cloudy waters between her awareness and the thick mire of her unconscious, like an underwater fault line settling into another place, leaving an echo that resonates through the water and across the earth. She knows he has gone. The rest of the poem is left unrecited. She continues to hold his lifeless hand, glad to have talked to him, wondering where he is now, wondering who cares. Eventually, she hears the faint chirp of a siren, no louder than birdsong, announce itself in the distance, becoming louder and more urgent until the blue flashing light is visible. Her suspended moment with the old man in the black frayed coat is gone. Booted men surround the empty body as if Amy's invisible. Maybe it's me who's died, she thinks. They lift him onto a stretcher and into a red ambulance, just as Lillian arrives. Amy shuts herself into the car and watches, as if in a dream, her mother talking to the men. One writes in a notebook as Lillian describes the event, pointing and gesturing with her arms. Amy thinks she looks as if she's dancing and sees that one of the men is transfixed by her, his head tilted to one side, gazing down the gaping front of her dress, drinking her in like a drug. As Lillian walks back towards the car, his eyes follow her thirstily. She gets in beside Amy with a deep sigh, her whole countenance seeming to drop as if its supports had collapsed, leaving her old and worn out. They sit watching the ambulance drive away in silence, its blue light dormant. That evening, Amy hides the pills in her wash bag, not wanting to be reminded of the doctor's probing fingers. Her thoughts keep returning to the old man and his rough hands and sitting there together by the side of the road. The soundless reverberations of his death fill her head, not with sadness, but with a sense that she has found something precious, though she's not sure. A couple of gendarmes arrive at the villa. Lillian, newly reconstructed in a white trouser suit, greets them warmly with an appropriate look of concern written across her face. She closes herself in the study with them, and the low murmur of their voices can be heard, but not understood, from outside on the terrace, where Amy sits waiting for them to call her in. They reappear in the doorway and take their leave, without even a glance in her direction. "Darling, there's something I must tell you," says Lillian, sitting beside her daughter, a freshly poured drink gleaming in her hand. "The old man died, you know." "Yes, I know," replies Amy quietly. "I saw his spirit leave his body." Oh!